Welcome back to the It Could Happen Here. Yeah, that's the podcast we're doing right now. It's a podcast about how things are kind of falling apart, but maybe they don't need to, or at least not as much as they have been. I'm Robert Evans. With me, as often, is my co-host, Garrison Davis. Garrison, say something inciting to the audience.
I'm on my second cup of coffee.
Yeah, because it is the early morning for you, by which I mean 2:11 in the afternoon. Also with us today, our guest for this episode is David Van Dusen. David, you are the president of the State Labor Council for the Vermont AFL-CIO, and there's a bunch of stuff that's interesting about your organization. We'll dig into it in more detail in a second, but first I just want to say hello and thank you for being on the show.
Pleasure to be here with you, Robert.
Now, David, the big thing, I mean, the Vermont AFL-CIO has been in the news a couple of times recently. The most recent one is y'all issued a statement making you, the coverage I've seen has said, the first labor organization in the U.S. to, like, support gun rights. I mean, like, as is stated in a lot of the stuff you've put out, like Blair Mountain, there's a long history of labor organizations sure. making use of the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. But I certainly haven't heard of a labor organization stating it the way you did, which is basically the case you've made is because far-right fascist organizations are so heavily armed and all of the gun control policies being heavily debated, at least among liberals, are likely to ignore those people while restricting the ability of working class and particularly marginalized people to arm themselves. You do not support those regulations because you support the rights of those groups to be able to defend themselves from fascists. That more or less correct?
Well, look, we believe in the right of a people to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. But our policies, including that one, are not adopted by the elected leadership, including myself. They're adopted by our members. We believe very firmly in democracy, participatory democracy. So with issues like this, we're happy to bring it to our convention, which we recently did, and facilitate a full debate on the issue. So that's exactly what we did. We talked about it. Our rank and file members talked about it. They made amendments. They debated passionately different sides of the issue in a respectful way, in a productive way. A number of amendments were made, they were adopted, and then ultimately the resolution was passed with over a two-thirds majority of our rank and file delegates in favor. So that's where we are right now.
Yeah, I've read a bit about this, including, you know, there's been some critiques from a representative from the AFT, which is the local teachers union. But there was also a member of the Vermont AFL-CIO who essentially stated, like, hey, I didn't actually agree with this amendment, but or with this resolution, but it was made democratically, and like I support the process by which it was done, which is one of the things I think is so interesting here, that this isn't like a kind of a group of activists at the top making declarations. This is an organization that has really dedicated itself increasingly to, I think, a kind of progressivism that we haven't really seen in an organized way in a lot of the American labor movement until recently.
Well, when you're talking about democracy within labor, I mean, we could be just as well talking about democracy in society as such. The fact is that organized labor today is not particularly democratic, and we're looking to change that. And our world is not particularly democratic. Now, the vision that we hold, our slate, our progressive slate called United, is one where we increase the means for direct participatory democracy, both within labor and within our society. So, of course, we're going to go to our members and our rank and file and ask them to debate the issues of our day and ultimately to make a decision on these major political and social issues. This was one. We do believe that people need to have a right. The working class needs to have a right to defend itself. And we can't bury our head in the sand. Anybody that's even followed a little bit of the news lately will know that between November 2020 up until late January 2021, we were one general shy of a coup in this country. In the upside down world that we're now living in, it was because of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the head of the CIA not supporting a coup that a neo-fascist coup didn't totally in full materialize in a more mature form. Let that sink in for a minute. Our democracy, or the vestiges of the democracy we have in the United States right now, is precarious. Just because they've been there for 200 years doesn't mean they're going to be there tomorrow. the new playbook from an increasingly far-right Republican Party is to limit as much as they possibly could of people's right to vote and to participate in the political process. We see this happening in Texas. We see this happening in Georgia. We see this happening in Florida. We see this happening in red, I shouldn't say red, but I should say Republican states all throughout the U.S. So these are dangerous, dangerous times, right? So dangerous that our top generals were trying to decide what their position would be and make plans in case a coup, a full-on coup, not just a hint of a coup, came into being within the last year of our republic. Now, given those realities and given the rise of the far right, given that our former president, Donald Trump, told the neo-fascist Proud Boys to stand, what did he say?
Stand back and stand by. Yeah,
that's right. And now at least they claim to have 40,000 members around the United States and they are armed. You know, we can't just rest on our laurels and pretend that the state as such is going to keep us safe. So it seems prudent and reasonable for us to have taken the action to say we defend our constitutional right to bear arms as intended, to defend our communities, to defend our unions, to defend the working class.
And one of the things that, because we were just talking about the coup that very nearly got pulled off, your organization, at least, in I believe it was right after the election in 2020, issued a statement that if the president illegally attempted to stay in power, the former president, you would participate in an attempt to help organize a general strike. Now, that's something we talk about a lot on this show. We're big believers in the potential of a general strike. We're also big believers that the kind of general strike that we need to, I don't know, potentially get climate justice and a number of other major things is an undertaking on par with the space race. You know, you're talking about an enormous task. I'm really interested in picking your brain on when we talk about a national general strike. What is the kind of infrastructure that's actually necessary to make something like that feasible? Because there's a lot of talk on like Twitter and Facebook of like, let's just do a general strike on this day in October.
I 6 months doesn't go by as president of AFL-CIO of Vermont where I don't a leftist group of some kind contacted me to endorse their general strike. Right.
Yeah.
The whole country is going to shut down on date X and it's yet to happen, at least in our country. So that's a great question. A couple things. When we voted, and again, this wasn't a decision of myself and the leadership. This was a decision we went back to the rank and file with to one of our conventions. 87% of our delegates after our hour-long debate voted to authorize the elected executive board to call for a general strike in the event of a coup, in the event that there wasn't a transfer of power on January 20th, as the Constitution requires. It was our feeling that in that very specific space and time, in that very specific political climate, we would be able to call for such a strike and with a serious amount of work and a serious amount of organizing, pull that off and make that happen. And the thought was if we could do it in Vermont, because the call was for a Vermont general strike, then it could spread to other states, which would be absolutely necessary if there was if our country descended into a fascist dictatorship of some sort. But generally speaking, when we talk about climate issues, when we talk about the fact that millions of Americans don't have health care or aren't paid livable wages, all of these issues, or at least these issues together, certainly warrant us looking at things like a general strike. But they're it's a bit pie in the sky to think that, hey, we got 10 great issues that we want to see progress on. We're going to call for a strike and it's going to happen. The infrastructure is not there, nor is the political will within the large labor bodies at this present time. Without participation from organized labor, first of all, I don't think anything's going to happen. So you're going to have to achieve buy-in at a certain level. But even with buy-in from key leaders or even a localized shop stewards, you still need to have infrastructure in place. So one of the things that lacks in the AFL-CIO as a national organization, we don't have an effective network of local union contacts in every shop, at every shift, in every factory that's represented by a union, let alone the majority of workplaces at this point that aren't unionized. So what our top priority is, as far as the Vermont AFL-CIO goes over the next 2 years, is to build a network of local union contacts in every single shop and every single shift that we represent folks here in Vermont. So we see this as a way to increase communication. Without communication, you're not going to be able to pull off mass mobilizations. And with, and also, you're not going to be able to conduct mass education on issues X, Y, or Z. So over a period of 2 years, we're looking to build this network that would function not as a one-way means of communication, but almost a two or three way. Imagine that this is a way for the rank and file to communicate up to the leaders. This is a way for the leadership to communicate down to the ranks. I mean, down to the lunchroom level of what it means to be in a union shop. And also, ideally, it's going to be a way for local union leaders to horizontally communicate with each other. With such a structure in place on a grand scale, on a state scale, on a federal scale, then things like organized general strikes over political issues and social issues become feasible. And even when they're feasible, though, then we still have the political question of, you know, will they be supported by the internationals? Will they be supported by the executive board of the National AFL-CIO? And that's a huge conversation in and of itself.
Yeah, it's interesting to me hearing your perspective on this, because my experience with kind of activism has been much more of kind of the decentralized and kind of much more recent groups, you know, since Occupy. You're dealing with these structures that in a lot of cases are, I mean, the AFL-CIO goes back like what, like a century, right? One way or the other. Yeah. You know, I think because of kind of how, shall I say, online, a lot of the discussion about this stuff seems to be, organized labor often gets left out. And one of the things that I think is most important when talking about the value that organized labor has in any kind of discussion of a general strike is what happened during the budget negotiations or whatever you want to call them in 2019, where you had airline workers threatening a general strike that effectively brought an end to a president saber rattling over over the budget. Like it's
President Sarah Nelson made headlines over that, and that was the right thing to do.
Absolutely,
to her. And would love to see her in a stronger position of leadership on the national level.
Well, I'm interested because I see a lot of potential in, obviously, organized labor has had a lot of problems, particularly in the last, you know, during my lifetime. And I think part of it is what you said earlier. It's not as democratic as it should be at most levels. What you guys have done with United is attempting to reform that, you know, within Vermont. I'm wondering first, how did that kind of come about? You know, 2019 is when you first got put into office, when the United slate got put into the office in Vermont. What was kind of the backstory to that? And then my second question is kind of, what do you see as necessary to, like, what's the fight as you see it to get stuff like that done on a larger scale around the country?
So our story in Vermont is probably a lot like the story of organized labor in many different places, mm-hmm. our starting point. So in 2017, not that long ago, we had a convention with something like 20 or 25 delegates there. Imagine that, 20 delegates representing, 10, at the time, 10,000, we've grown since then, but 10,000 members. Mm-hmm. And that's called a democracy. So there was a problem, an existential problem. Now, I come out of AFSCME, local 2413 in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. So when I got together with a number of other leaders from different unions, different AFSCME locals, but also United Academics as part of AFT, the building trades, a number of folks, there was a general recognition at the leadership level that something was very wrong. Member participation was weak as can be, and things had to change. And we continually, as an organization, you know, with some exceptions, hitched our wagon to the shortcomings that are the Democratic Party. So all of these things together led to inactivity, apathy, and lack of democracy. So we started going around. We started talking with workers. We started talking with shops across the state. And one of the first things that was striking, people would say, they would know what union they're in, be it APWU or AFSCME or whatever it was. But we'd say, listen, we're thinking about running a slate, a progressive slate for office to take the AFL-CIO in a new direction. The next thing they would say is, what's the AFL-CIO? Think about that, right? Mm-hmm. Workers involved, some of which were union stewards in their locals, didn't even know what the AFL-CIO was. So that was our starting point. It was an existential crisis of labor. And mind you, during these, what I would call some dark periods, we would often endorse 100 candidates for state house, nearly all of which being Democrats. And then they would win. They would win their elections. Oh, like largely our candidates would win. And then we'd get nothing in the state house, right? There'd be no labor bill. There'd be no advancement of card check, mm-hmm. different things for organized labor. And yet we keep repeating the same mistake year in, year out, and not figure out that something was wrong. So when we formed the United Slate as a coalition of a number of different unions to recognize it was time for change, we really brought the discussion to the grassroots level. We developed a 10-point program. We call it our little green book. It's now the policy and the platform of the Vermont AFL-CIO. And we ran an organized campaign based on that, right, at a very local level. And here, we did all the things that, you know, you should be doing, the phone calls, the emails, the shop visits, all of this, and created a sense of excitement going into our 2019 convention. Our 2019 convention with over, if I recall, over 105 delegates and alternates was the largest convention we had up here in something like 30 plus years. So that was an exciting atmosphere where something was going to be different and something was going to change, right? So we essentially swept those elections. We won all the seats except for one. We had a follow-up convention election in 2020, where we won every single seat. And then the last election, we won all seats except for one, where one person who's a good person from the building trades ran but was not part of our state. So the real question is, what have we done in the interim? How are we changing that direction? And how are we trying to change the capacity of labor? And what lessons does it have to the national labor movement, I would suppose? Mm-hmm. So on that front, one of the first things we did is we took money out of our lobbying operation and put it to an organizing department whereby we would hire, and we have hired, on-call organizers to assist our affiliates in either new organizing or internal organizing, therefore delivering an actual benefit to our affiliate unions. Now, mind you, we represent just about every sector of workers all across the state, but forever, they very rarely gotten concrete, measurable acts of solidarity from the Federation as such, right? Because too many of the resources were put into lobbying. And we also took a critical eye towards the Democratic Party. And recently, we've instead endorsed the Social Democratic Vermont Progressive Party slates in their runs for state house and statewide office in many cases. So we've done a few things differently. We're continuing to do things differently. We've expanded the size of our executive board. So we elect more leaders now. We've more than doubled the size of the delegates afforded to each local, so we could have more rank and file voices present when we're meeting at a convention. And we've taken a strong social justice position where we think that organized labor must work very closely in an alliance, form alliances with groups like Migrant Justice or Black Perspective or environmental organizations like 350.org. And we've done those things, worked on their issues where we have common interests, and we've asked them to support us on our issues where they may have some common interests. So those are things that are very different that the national AFL-CIO is not doing. Other state labor federations largely aren't doing them enough. And we're hoping now to build that out. And we're engaged in conversations seeking to form a national progressive caucus within the national AFL-CIO.
And I think that's so important when you talk about kind of on the national level for progressives. Number one, to not continually kind of reflexively support the Democratic Party when the Democratic Party is failing progressives, which, you know, we have a perfect case study right now in Congress with the reconciliation bill. It often does seem like such an insurmountable task just because the inability, like a bill, the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill is so widely supported by Americans, but it just keeps coming down to this tiny number of folks with, financial interests and donors who are pushing against something that's widely supported. And I feel optimistic when I look at state organizations like what y'all are doing and the fact that I can see something building. But I also, it is such a titanic task to imagine translating that on a national scale in a way that actually gets us the things that, you know, we really can't wait for when you're talking about some of this infrastructure stuff, when you're talking about healthcare, when you're talking about climate justice. Like, I do feel the clock ticking. And I'm wondering what you see as the hope on the national scale for actually putting some muscle behind the progressive movement.
Well, look, it's not just the issues of the infrastructure bill and the budget bill. It's also the PRO Act, right? The PRO bill that is languished in the Senate. And let's not lose track of the fact that those efforts are all stalling and likely, very likely to fail. And I hope they don't, because of Democrats, because the Democratic Party is not united. They ran on a platform saying they were going to do X, Y, and Z. And now when they're in a position to carry it out, they're not going to do it. And Joe Manchin, as far as I'm concerned, I call him a class traitor, but I don't think he's ever was part of the working class. He claims to support the PRO Act, but in the same breath, he won't get rid of the filibuster. So, I mean, that's absolute bullshit as far as I'm concerned. So how do we change that? Well, the national AFL-CIO puts millions and millions and millions of dollars into elections. We have gotten so many of these people elected and backed them in Arizona and West Virginia, you name it. And then we get nothing back. If we were to take that money instead and put it into a robust new organizing department or a recrafted organizing department and actually assign real on the ground organizers in every single state in the country to help our affiliates, to help our state federations and their affiliates to internally organize, to build the kind of network I was talking about before, and to be active and build alliances with social justice groups, our power would be amplified 5 million-fold. This is the way we do it. Politicians aren't going to do what's right because it's right. Politicians are going to do what's right when they feel so much pressure that they have to do it. Now, the victories that we saw for working people during the Great Depression under FDR, that wasn't just because FDR thought, you know, this is the right thing to do. It's because people were going on strike, because people were organized, because they were scared of revolutionary change in this country. So turned to meaningful, true, major reforms as a way to blunt that perceived threat that they had. And that's what we got to get back to. Our power is never going to grow from people who are wearing ties in Washington. Our power is going to grow based on our solidarity on the shop floor and in our communities. So that's the direction we got to go. And we got to do that rapidly, very rapidly.
It's been clear to me for quite a while, both that the reason workers gained so much in the wake of the Great Depression, and the only kind of hope we have for doing that now is they have to be scared, you know, to an extent. They have to be scared of what's arrayed against them, both in its organization and in its ability to disrupt things. And I'm wondering what you think people listening, people who maybe are not involved in organized labor, like what do you think people can do to further those ends? Like, this is like when we start talking about national level AFL-CIO politics, that's not something I think most people listening feel like they have any kind of ability to influence. What do you think they can influence? What do you think people can be doing to build that kind of capacity?
Well, you got to be active and you got to engage in the political and social movements, but also most folks, you know, they're going to have a job of some kind. And a lot of folks aren't getting treated the way they should in their job. I don't care if you work in a coffee shop, in a restaurant, or in a gas station, or in manufacturing. And you could start by organizing with your coworkers to form a union today. You know, you could reach out to a local union to ask for help, or you could do it on your own, frankly. But if we're not organized as working people, and we are the 99%, we are most of the world. If we're not organized amongst ourselves, we're not going to be able to become that expression of power that we need to be in order to create the change. If we're just a collection of individuals, then the ruling class, the wealthy, the powerful, the elite, they're going to have all their ducks in a row to keep us divided and to keep their foot on the pedal of the status quo. So we need to come together. We need to organize. And the natural place to organize is in the workplace, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it is the natural place to organize. It's also become an increasingly difficult place to organize. We all watch what Amazon did in Bessemer this year, mm-hmm. you know, and that fight is still ongoing to an extent. But it is a continuing challenge to actually effectively unionize in a lot of the industries where it matters most, you know. Sure. Like we have some choke point industries, like we talked about aircraft employees that are heavily unionized, thankfully, and that do have a lot of power, as has been demonstrated recently when they go to the mat. But I'm interested in kind of we've got, you know, Amazon employees is really one of the areas that I'm looking at where, my God, if we could actually if something significant could actually get off the ground and a significant number of those workers could get organized, it could mm-hmm. make a real difference. But, you know, you've got effectively what are community organizations for the most part going up against, you know, Amazon at this point has more resources than most nation states.
Yeah, but so do the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the folks like this. And organizing.
Absolutely.
And it's always been hard. Mm-hmm. Too long ago in our country, maybe during our grandfather's day, where there was a very good chance you'd be shot or at least beat over the head with a club from the Pinkertons if you tried to organize. Organizing has never been easy. In countries such as Colombia today, trade unionists are killed at an unbelievable clip almost on a daily basis, and yet still they organize. So I'm not suggesting to any of your listeners that any of this is easy. What I am saying is that it has to happen. It has to happen. And there's different models, too. Like in some places, one of the models that's been effectively used is forming worker centers, right? So that's not a traditional union. It's a center in a city or in a community or in a town where workers come together and strategize, right, at in a location to strategize how to be effective as a group, as a whole, as a class on issues that are important to them, you know, be it economic, be it social, be it fighting against racism, whatever it may be. That's a model that I suggest folks could look into as an alternative way if, for whatever reason, you don't feel that the time is ripe for a union in your shop today, although it needs to be tomorrow. Take a look at Worker Center and see if there's one in your community, get involved. If not, get together a few people and see what it would take to start one where you live. But one way or another, we have to be organized. We have to come together. We cannot just be a collection of individuals.
That's a great point and useful information. I think kind of the last thing I wanted to get into was one of the things I first learned about your organization, that you issued a solidarity statement back in, I think it was 2019, with the YPG and J in Rojava. And you've issued, you know, stated your solidarity with Black Lives Matter, with the Zapatistas, currently what they're undergoing in Mexico, which is massive repression from the government yet again. And, you know, your support of Palestinian rights and of against sort of the U.S. occupation, or not occupation, but a blockade of Cuba. What do you see when we're talking about this struggle, this broad struggle we've been talking about all day? What do you see as the role of internationalism in both organizing people and organizing resistance?
Well, our starting point today is capital is international. So if mm-hmm. we're going to have a foundational challenge to the power of capital, we also have to be internationalists in our outlook. We supported the YPG and the YPJ and the newly elected government in Rojava because they are struggling for economic equity and a direct participatory democracy in that corner of the world. And we see this as the most significant revolution in the world in generations. I mean, this in our mind is on par with the Spanish Civil War and what we saw around Barcelona and the CNT then, or the Paris Commune of 1871. If this was happening in Europe, a day wouldn't go by where this wouldn't be front page news. But in the Western world, we often, the corporate media turns a blind eye to many of those struggles. So they're doing their part. And we have to do our part in our country, too. The Zapatistas are doing their part in Chiapas and in broader ways in some regards in Mexico as such. But we need to reach our hand out in encouragement and say, hey, we're here to support you. One of the things we sought to concretely do in the Vermont labor movement is in 2019, one of our central labor councils passed a resolution in support. We said, look, if you go over to fight and volunteer with the YPG and YPJ, because there's thousands of volunteers right there who have volunteered to go over. If you return and you're American, we'll hook you up with a union job and we'll hook you up with 3 months of room and board. So you could get reacclimated, you could get back into the community and get back into the local fight through the labor movement. And we were proud to actually have an opportunity to do that for one returning American fighter. In our latest resolution in 2021, and this one was broader because it was the whole Vermont AFL-CIO, not just the Central Labor Council, we again offered, we encourage folks to feel so inclined if they're in that place in their life to volunteer with the YPG and YPJ. And if they're Americans and they come back, we're happy to hook you up. We'll do our best to get you a good union job when you return. So we felt that was a very small, least we could do kind of thing, but concrete way to provide solidarity. We all have to stand together. It's really one fight, but the place we're going to be effective is where you live locally, in your town, in your city, in your state, and in your country.
Yeah, I think that's a great note to end on and a great thing that you all are doing. And I really do appreciate that. And I appreciate you, David, coming on and talking to us today. Is there anything else you wanted to get out or anything you wanted to, like, any, you know, charities or mutual aid funds or whatever you wanted to push before we kind of roll out today?
I just like to push for folks to go to work tomorrow and organize. Organize with your fellow workers and let's change the world. Solidarity.
Thank you, David. Robert Evans here, and I wanted to ask for your help. There is a Portland area woman, Ruba Tamimi. She's an Arabic interpreter and a Palestinian liberation activist, and she is trying to save her home at the moment. She's got a GoFundMe. If you go to Save Ruba's House, R-U-B-A, on GoFundMe, you'll find it. Save Ruba's House on GoFundMe. If you've got a few bucks, she could really use it. Again, Save Ruba's House, R-U-B-A, at GoFundMe. Thanks.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.